The Antioch Podcast.
Conversations about biblical anti-racism.
Have mercy.
Let me say it one more time.
The Antioch Podcast.
The Antioch Podcast is a ministry of Preach System.
Oh, I got Jesus, yay.
Hello, welcome to the Antioch Podcast, conversations about biblical anti-racism. My name is Eric Nykamp. The Antioch Podcast takes its name from the ancient city of Antioch, the first multi-ethnic church mentioned in the Bible in Acts 11. Because they had no single ethnic identifier, Romans who mocked followers of the way in Antioch called them little Christs or Christians. A name which those early believers soon adopted as a badge of pride. Because of Antioch's location on what became known as the Silk Road, Christians in Antioch were instrumental in spreading Christianity throughout the world for centuries. Our podcast is hosted by a multicultural team of Christian anti-racism educators and friends, and biblical anti-racism is the starting point of all our conversations. Let's go now and listen to today's conversation.
Hello, everyone. Today on the Antioch Podcast, we're going to be talking about the question, is colorblindness a Christian virtue? Here today to talk about this are members of our multi-ethnic team, and because representation matters in these conversations about biblical anti-racism, we're going to go around and give a name, our racial or ethnic identifier, before jumping in to discuss the topic of the day. I'll go first. My name is Hannah, and I identify as a white woman.
I'm Michelle, and I identify as an African-American woman.
I'm Reggie, and I identify as an African-American male.
Hi, I'm Eric. I identify as a white guy.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for being here. So we're going to explore, is colorblindness a Christian virtue? And today, I just want to start this conversation with defining what colorblindness is in the context of racial justice specifically, not in terms of a medical condition. So what is colorblindness?
Oh, can I throw in just for a minute that I'm actually colorblind? Okay. Which I heard. Did you know that white people, like biologically speaking, are more likely to be colorblind? I just heard that.
Really?
Okay, so that, which I thought was a little ironic, but as someone who's actually colorblind, you know how dangerous that is if you leave to go to work in the morning and no one can give you a fit check?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you might look like an idiot all the time.
Hannah, could you give us your definition of colorblindness?
Sure. So colorblindness, and the way that we're going to talk about it today, is the idea that we should not see color when we engage with one another, that we should not see race, that we should just see each other as people, and we should keep race out of our conversations with one another. Now, this is a popular perspective for a lot of different groups. For a long time, it was also seen as like a politically correct viewpoint. It's a favorite posture of certain church groups and white evangelicals. And we're going to explore a little bit about why we think that has become a favorite posture for people in different communities, especially white communities. Anybody have any thoughts on that, on why it's become a favorite posture, to take us away?
One of the things that I think about with that position, it's kind of like Easter, right? There's Good Friday. Then there's Saturday. Well, we want to deal with the entrance into the city, right? Jesus, all the celebration. Let's skip over the crucifixion. Let's skip over the silent Saturday. And then let's get to Easter. Let's just do the celebrating. We don't want to deal with the bad stuff. So for me, the kind of avoidance or the resistance for saying we're going to allow race into the story, is because if we're serious about understanding the impact of race on a person's life in a community, we have to understand the history of race. Even if the person in front of us who appears to be a part of a racial ethnic group, their story, how we know them, I don't know, they're our best friend. We don't know them as having had any kind of racist experience, right? And so we want to be colorblind and say, this is just my fishing buddy. This is just the person I go play bingo with. This is just the person I sit next to in church. They don't experience any of that kind of troublesome stuff. And so we never talk about it when their lives more than likely are being really impacted by what's going on around. And if I have to, if the person is saying, well, if I have to take race into consideration, I need to take into consideration how I enter into the story. How does my race shape my life? I don't want to deal with that, right? I used to do this exercise in teaching an intro level class, asking people to write down just briefly, how has your racialized identity impact you on any given day? The people of color in the room writing, right? And then the white people look like deer in the headlights. What? I don't have racialized experience, right? And I would see this happening and I wouldn't save them, right? But then before I allow people to give feedback, I would say, you know, I don't know what it's like to be able to navigate a community, a society where my experience, what I see in the mirror, is the norm everywhere I go. I don't know what it's like for my cultural identity that I don't even have to think about it. It just is. I don't know what it's like to go into a restaurant and not have to worry about, is there going to be food that really pertains to my palate? I don't know what it's like to look at magazines and just assume that people are going to look like me. In fact, I was so unaware of it that when I took a trip to Ghana and saw these massive billboards of people that look like me not advertising cigarettes or alcohol, it's like, oh my gosh, we can advertise soup? Oh my gosh, this is amazing, right? I don't know what that's like. So white people, you do have a racialized identity. You just don't have to think about it. So I think that's why the pull towards colorblindness, because then you don't have to think about your race if you're a privileged identity. But I will say also for some people of color wanting to promote colorblindness, because then you don't have to think about race as well. And I don't have to address that racist comment that you said was just a joke, because I want to maintain the friendship.
I'll throw this in too. And I know this study is 12 years old. So this is pre-Trump. PRRI did a study about friendship and race. And one of the findings, this is from 2014, PRRI's data shows that a full 75% of white people have entirely white social networks without any minority presence. And the same holds true for slightly less than 2/3 of Black Americans. So in terms of lived experience, the lived experience of white people, if we are in fact colorblind, is that we're actually primarily socializing with white people, and a lot of us exclusively with white people, which kind of makes that really questionable. Even if you could be colorblind, are you comfortable? And it kind of seems that our lived experience actually doesn't live up to that colorblind status that we are trying to strive for, if that was indeed something that was worth striving for.
Well, I think another question that I want to ask about colorblindness, and I'm curious about what you guys think about this, is it's often painted as, out of the fear of talking about race being divisive and it's going to hurt people, is colorblindness a harmless alternative?
No, it's still harmful. It's harmful in the sense of that for white people, in terms of this color blindness toolkit, is that if I'm just doing personal relationship stuff, that should fix it, right? And it's so very individualistic. I mean, there's a common thing that comes up with, if you bring up slavery, well, my family never owned slaves, or we had nothing to do with slavery, or that was 200 years ago and we had nothing to do with that. It becomes a way of avoiding and compartmentalizing the actual history that is right in front of you. It is completely normal to say that personal relationships are important, but they're not an answer to what's really wrong. I can have personal relationships, and we see that being acted out right now. If you just think about the young man in Mississippi who went out with his four white friends, and he didn't come back alive. And all that came up in terms of the media was race. Why was he the only one to die? Yeah. Why were certain things happening? But it just speaks back to a racial history that we all know that is there, but it's so hard and painful to deal with that it's easy just to look at an individual rather than look at a whole group of people. And research has shown us we would rather deal with one person than to deal with a group of people because it's easier. You can handle that. You don't get overwhelmed with it. But it's particularly among white evangelicals. And all we have to do is look back at 2016. And research has shown this too, that 81% of people voted for a particular president. And most of those were white evangelicals who said, this person is for us. Or in the case of our 44th president, okay, now you've had this president. We're all good now, right? And it's we want these magical solutions that become a way of avoiding the painfulness, but also the reality that's there, that's never going away. And so how does the church, and maybe asking this question, why are multiracial churches maybe isn't the answer for, or maybe is that a incubator for color blindness? Is it good or is it bad?
I think part of the problem that I've noticed with colorblindness and this idea is that race also has been attributed to, it's political if we talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes a thing where a lot of churches become colorblind, just not in maybe not even in name, but they don't talk about racial issues, systemic injustice, because we can't get political at church. And it becomes a whether we're saying the word colorblind or not, sometimes it feels like it becomes the default. We're not dealing with it at church. And so it becomes easier to say, well, why do we need to deal with it at all? Why do we need to talk about it? Like we're all just people. If we're in a multicultural church, we can worship together just fine on Sunday. Why do we need to talk about the realities of racial injustice and how it's impacting, you know, the brothers and sisters in my congregation on Monday?
I wonder, especially multiracial churches, and you make a very fine point, Hannah, that we just want to just see people as people. And yet at the same time, the class dynamics come up. And it's nice that we do it at 11 o'clock where everybody's cool and everything. And yet that single black mother has to go back and all of the disadvantages are there. And for her white counterparts, all the advantages go with them. And I think that's one of the things that makes it because we, I mean, as Americans, we don't want to admit that we have advantages because everybody works hard. They pull themselves up. That narrative that everybody can get ahead if they just try hard. And yet at the same time, some groups of people had advantages. You know, when Black GIs came out of World War II, they weren't given GI bills. They couldn't build a suburban house in Levi or in Levittstown or outside of Chicago. They weren't given those same privileges. Or if you talk about in terms of Grand Rapids, they were not given the GI Bill to build a house in Alger Heights, mm-hmm. or in Easttown or on the northwest side of town. And those are kind of the painful social systems that we have to talk about, but becomes very difficult because we want to maintain this facade that everything is good.
One of the reasons I'm kind of sitting quiet is because I'm thinking about a number of conversations I've had in the last week where we talked about the overlap between race and class. Mm-hmm. And some of that felt so private that I don't feel like I can talk about it on air, mm-hmm. besides saying that, like, that is a huge factor. And that since the history of racism in America has left the impact of huge class differences as well, mm-hmm. that there's multiple things that we're trying to navigate here. And what we talk about and what we're familiar talking about and who we would consider as being like us, right? All these kind of things are impacted by both of those things. Mm-hmm. It's really deep. I mean, I don't know if you can get it all at either a multi-ethnic church or a mono-ethnic church. I think it depends on what you need. Then can you get it all? There's advantages and disadvantages to both. Mm-hmm. And it is what it is, at least at this time in history.
Right. And I just consider that as Americans, it's a very hard thing to talk about, mm-hmm. advantages and disadvantages. To talk about social systems that favors one group of people over another, because we are so, we want to believe that narrative that everybody has an equal chance, and that's not our history. And we can say, well, we can point to the Bible where it was done that way. Well, all you have to do is go is Acts 6 and 7, between where there were Jewish widows and there were Hellenistic Greek women who did not, there was one group who got more than the other. And it became a pivotal point where the church had to deal with inequity. Mm-hmm. And it did it in a way of saying, well, we need to do something about it. And here's where we get our deacons. And so the church demonstrates that it's willing to acknowledge that there was an issue. The apostles acknowledged something's wrong and we got to do something about it. Mm-hmm. Secondly, they were willing to investigate. They were willing to do fact finding. They didn't try to defend themselves or to bully people. And when they got to a decision that said, well, didn't we need to have those who are impacted by it to be the ones who lead it? And if you notice, and we've talked about this in other episodes, the names are all Greek, not Jewish. Mm-hmm. There's something significant about that. It's that they are willing to put those who were impacted by it in charge of the very thing in which the inequity happened in order to bring equality. And that's something that I think that the church can continue to look back at and to learn from is how do we distribute not only resources, but also power and dignity and respect in the same thing. And if churches were willing to do that, But unfortunately, we have people who are really great as conflict entrepreneurs, is what I call them, who holler out to us unfairness, grievance. Somebody's taking something from you. Somebody's did something wrong to you, and you need to get what is yours. And we've allowed that kind of language to really take over our conversations in our churches. And I'm just wondering for you, Eric and Hannah, what can we do to recover that? What small ways in which listeners can resist that?
I think in the last episode, you talked about, Reggie, the importance of understanding stories. I guarantee if you are a deacon in a church, you are being asked to intervene in some situations that knowing the story would be really, really important. I've never gotten to be a deacon. I'm a social worker, and I know you're a social worker. Reggie, I know you're a pastor. Like, you hear people's stories, right?
Yep.
But also to understand that everybody is not starting from the same place. Everybody does not have the same values. Everybody has not had the same kind of role models. It is very messy. Understanding story is exceptionally critical. I mean, I love that story about the Hellenistic, you know, the Greek speaking and the Hebrew widows. I get it why in a predominantly Jewish power structure, Jewish people who've kind of like experienced hardship got seen in some ways as like, well, we have a lot of compassion for them. We can understand their story. But these Greek speaking people, like we don't understand that story. Like, we don't even speak that language. We don't know what that's like. You know, maybe if they act more like Jewish people, they wouldn't be in such a bad spot. Mm. Right. And I'm sure that's just a human thing, right?
Right. Right.
How often do we do that? Especially if for white folks, like, we're in power in most positions in our lives, or at least our values are adhered to. I know I hear white people saying, like, man, if they just made a few better decisions, they wouldn't end up in this jam. That can be a real dangerous place to sit.
Yeah.
Also very understandable, because you only have your own context to go from. But is that enough?
And I'm thinking of what you said, Eric, is that the whole Old Testament is about a people who weren't a people, who were oppressed. And then God comes in and rescues them from the Egyptians. And then they get into the promised land. And the last thing Moses says to them, the whole book of Deuteronomy is about Moses warning them, now that you are going to experience all of the bounty and abundance that the Lord has for you, don't get arrogant. Don't think that you are the one that made this happen. Moses spends almost 30 chapters, same sermon. And I'm sure that the Israelites were bored. Like, okay, we know. It's like telling the kid 12 times not to touch the stove, and yet that kid still wants to touch it. And it's the same with the Israelites, or for any of us, when we experience God's abundance, the first thing we want to do is hoard it. We don't want to give it away because we like what that gives us. It gives us certainty and control. And yet the Lord says, I was the one who gave you everything that you've had in order that you may share with others who do not, and distribute power so that there's always an opportunity to have better relationships and be a light to the world. If you act sacrificially to the world will pick that up and say, wow, that's crazy. Why are they doing that? But it is right about who God is. And Israel was built to be more like who God is. and yet they resisted. I'm thinking of when they got a king, 42 of the kings in both Israel and Judah were awful. They screwed up. So, and what did they have? They had power.
So going back to our question, is colorblindness a Christian virtue? The idea of colorblindness is willfully not seeing a part of somebody's identity. And I don't think scripturally that's a Christian posture. I don't think we see Jesus taking that posture. I don't think we see him asking us to take that posture with others. I don't think we see him saying, I love my children if I ignore these qualities about them. I think we see him loving fully and not loving in spite of, but loving us as he created us and loving us knowing who we are and the goods and the bads about us and asking us to do the same. Colorblindness affects every level of our society because it was a posture that was adopted intentionally after the civil rights movement as a political tool to say, well, if we don't talk about it, people won't care. People will maybe start to not care. And then on the other hand, we can develop policies that don't say, that don't talk about race, but still hurt people. Mm-hmm. Our criminal justice system operates incredibly on race. We just don't say it does. Our laws are passed based a lot on racial division. We just don't say that it does anymore. Schools are segregated, but we just don't say that they are anymore. Our church services are separated. We just don't talk about it. Race still divides us in so many ways, and it still impacts us on so many levels. Whether we are a person of color or not, we are all living into racial power structures. We all are. Being colorblind is choosing to be willfully ignorant. We can choose that if we want to. But we need to know that that's what we're choosing if we're adopting a position of colorblindness. We need to know that we're choosing if we are white or if we're a person of color. If we're choosing to say, I'm colorblind and I'm not seeing race, we're choosing to ignore something that is impacting us. And if we're white, we are choosing to ignore something that's causing active harm to people around us. And we are participating in that and benefiting from that. So take all that, think about it, do what you will with it. But in my opinion, with this conversation in mind, the answer to is colorblindness a Christian virtue is the easiest no I think I've had on this podcast since we've started it. It's something that flies in the face of a lot of what Jesus has asked us to do when we love each other. He didn't sit at tables with tax collectors going, I'm just not going to think about where you come from and what you're doing here. So think about that, because race is not a sin. It's not a bad thing. It's not something negative to talk about. It's good and important that we explore how identity affects us all. All different parts of our identity affect us. So talk about it and don't ignore it and don't avoid it. For all of you who stayed with us to the end of this podcast, thank you for listening to this episode of the Antioch Podcast. It's our prayer that all of these different conversations about biblical anti-racism inspire you to live countercultural lives marked by both justice and mercy while walking humbly with God. Whether you like this episode or not, don't forget to like and subscribe. And until next time, keep the faith and keep fighting for justice. This has been the Antioch Podcast.
You've been listening to the Antioch Podcast, conversations about biblical anti-racism. You can help us by spreading the word about the Antioch Podcast, by praying for us, sharing this episode on your social media, writing us a review, or supporting us financially by clicking on the support link on our website, www.antiochpodcast.org. Music, editing, and production of the Antioch Podcast provided by Eric Nykamp. Thanks for listening, and thank you for your support.